not the first. This more empathetic approach could lead to warmer relations between the police and the policed, and fewer of the tragedies we've seen in recent years, the police killings of young black men and the riots that follow them. From a mathematical point of view, however, trust is hard to quantify. That's a challenge for people building models. Sadly, it's far simpler to keep counting arrests, to build models that assume we're birds of a feather and treat us as such. Innocent people surrounded by criminals get treated badly, and criminals surrounded by a law-abiding public get a pass. And because of the strong correlation between poverty and reported crime, the poor continue to get caught up in these digital dragnets. The rest of us barely have to think about them. Chapter 6. Ineligible to serve. Getting a job. A few years ago, a young man named Kyle Beam took a leave from his studies at Vanderbilt University. He was suffering from bipolar disorder and needed time to get treatment. A year and a half later, Kyle was healthy enough to return to his studies at a different school. Around that time, he learned from a friend about a part-time job at Kroger. It was just a minimum wage job at a supermarket, but it seemed like a sure thing. His friend, who was leaving the job, could vouch for him. For a high-achieving student like Kyle, the application looked like a formality. But Kyle didn't get called back for an interview. When he inquired, his friend explained to him that he had been red-lighted by the personality test he'd taken when he applied for the job. The test was part of an employee selection program developed by Kronos, a workforce management company based outside of Boston. When Kyle told his father, Roland, an attorney, what had happened, his father asked him what kind of questions had appeared on the test. Kyle said that they were very much like the five-factor model test which he'd been given at the hospital. That test grades people for extroversion, agreeableness, conscientiousness, neuroticism, and openness to ideas. At first, losing one minimum wage job because of a questionable test didn't seem like such a big deal. Roland Beam urged his son to apply elsewhere. But Kyle came back each time with the same news. The companies he was applying to were all using the same test, and he wasn't getting offers. Roland later recalled, "Kyle said to me, I had an almost perfect SAT, and I was at Vanderbilt a few years ago. If I can't get a part-time minimum wage job, how broken am I?" And I said, "I don't think you're that broken." But Roland Beam was bewildered. Questions about mental health appeared to be blackballing his son from the job market. He decided to look into it and soon learned that the use of personality tests for hiring was indeed widespread among large corporations. And yet he found very few legal challenges to this practice. As he explained to me, people who apply for a job and are red-lighted rarely learn that they were rejected because of their test results. Even when they do, they're not likely to contact a lawyer. Beam went on to send notices to 7 companies: Finish Line, Home Depot, Kroger, Lowe's, PetSmart, Walgreen Company, and Yum Brands, informing them of his intent to file a class action suit, alleging that the use of the exam during the job application process was unlawful. The suit, as I write this, is still pending. Arguments are likely to focus on whether the Kronos test can be considered a medical exam, the use of which in hiring is illegal under the Americans with Disabilities Act of 1990. If this turns out to be the case, the court will have to determine whether the hiring companies themselves are responsible for running afoul of the ADA or if Kronos is. The question for this audiobook is how automatic systems judge us when we seek jobs and what criteria they evaluate. Already, we've seen WMDs poisoning the college admissions process, both for the rich and for the middle class. Meanwhile, WMDs in criminal justice rope in millions, the great majority of them poor, most of whom never had the chance to attend college at all. Members of each of these groups face radically different challenges. But they have something in common, too. They all ultimately need a job. Finding work used to be largely a question of whom you knew. In fact, Kyle Beam was following the traditional route when he applied for work at Kroger. His friend had alerted him to the opening and put in a good word. For decades, that was how people got a foot in the door, whether at grocers, the docks, banks, or law firms. Candidates then usually face an interview, where a manager would try to get a feel for them. All too often, this translated into a single basic judgment. Is this person like me, or others I get along with? The result was a lack of opportunity for job seekers without a friend inside, especially if they came from a different race, ethnic group, or religion. Women also found themselves excluded by this insider game. Companies like Kronos brought science into corporate human resources, in part to make the process fairer. Founded in the 1970s by MIT graduates, Kronos's first product was a new kind of punch clock, one equipped with a microprocessor, which added up employees' hours and reported them automatically. This may sound banal, but it was the beginning of the electronic push, now blazing along at warp speed, to track and optimize a workforce. As Kronos grew, it developed a broad range of software tools for workforce management, including a software program, Workforce Ready HR, that promised to eliminate the guesswork in hiring, according to its webpage. Quote, "We can help you screen, hire, and onboard candidates most likely to be productive, the best fit employees who will perform better and stay on the job longer." Kronos is part of a burgeoning industry. The hiring business is automating, and many of the new programs include personality tests like the one Kyle Beam took. It is now a $500 million annual business, and is growing by 10 to 15% a year, according to Hogan Assessment Systems, Inc., a testing company. Such tests are now used on 60 to 70% of prospective workers in the United States, up from 30 to 40% about 5 years ago, estimates Josh Berzin of the consulting firm Deloitte. Naturally, these hiring programs can't incorporate information about how the candidate would actually perform at the company. That's in the future, and therefore unknown. So, like many other big data programs, they settle for proxies. And as we've seen, proxies are bound to be inexact and often unfair. In fact, the Supreme Court ruled in a 1971 case, Griggs versus Duke Power Company, that intelligent tests for hiring were discriminatory and therefore illegal. One would think that case might have triggered some soul-searching, but instead the industry simply opted for replacements, including personality tests like the one that red-flagged Kyle Beam. Even putting aside the issues of fairness and legality, research suggests that personality tests are poor predictors of job performance. Frank Schmidt, a business professor at the University of Iowa, analyzed a century of workplace productivity data to measure the predictive value of various selection processes. Personality tests ranked low on the scale. They were only one-third as predictive as cognitive exams, and also far below reference checks. This is particularly galling because certain personality tests, research shows, can actually help employees gain insight into themselves. They can also be used for team building and for enhancing communication. After all, they create a situation in which people think explicitly about how to work together. That intention alone might end up creating a better working environment. In other words, if we define the goal as a happier worker, personality tests might end up being a useful tool. But instead, they're being used as a filter to weed out applicants. The primary purpose of the test, said Roland Beam, is not to find the best employee, is to exclude as many people as possible, as cheaply as possible. You might think that personality tests would be easy to game. If you go online to take a 5-factor personality test, it looks like a cinch. One question asks, have frequent mood swings? It would probably be smart to answer, very inaccurate. Another asks, get mad easily? Again, check no. Not too many companies want to hire hotheads. In fact, companies can get in trouble for screening out applicants on the basis of such questions. Regulators in Rhode Island found that CVS Pharmacy was illegally screening out applicants with mental illnesses when a personality test required respondents to agree or disagree to such statements as, quote, people do a lot of things that make you angry, and, quote, there's no use having close friends, they always let you down. More intricate questions, which are harder to game, are more likely to keep the companies out of trouble. Consequently, many of the tests used today force applicants to make difficult choices, likely leaving them with a sinking feeling of, damned if I do, damned if I don't. McDonald's, for example, asked prospective workers to choose which of the following best described them. It is difficult to be cheerful when there are many problems to take care of. Or, sometimes I need a push to get started on my work. The Wall Street Journal asked an industrial psychologist, Tomas Chamorro Pramuzic, to analyze thorny questions like these. The first item, Chamorro Pramuzic said, captured, quote, individual differences in neuroticism and conscientiousness. The second, quote, low ambition and drive. So the prospective worker is pleading guilty to being either high-strung or lazy. A Kroger question was far simpler. Which adjective best describes you at work, unique or orderly? Answering unique, said Shimuro Primusich, captures high self-concept, openness, and narcissism, while orderly expresses conscientiousness and self-control. Note that there's no option to answer all of the above. Prospective workers must pick one option, without a clue as to how the program will interpret it. And some of the analysis will draw unflattering conclusions. If you go to a kindergarten class in much of the country, for example, you'll often hear teachers emphasize to the children that they're unique. It's an attempt to boost their self-esteem, and of course, it's true. Yet, 12 years later, when that student chooses unique on a personality test while applying for a minimum wage job, the program might read the answer as a red flag. Who wants a workforce peopled with narcissists? Defenders of the test note that they feature lots of questions and that no single answer can disqualify an applicant. Certain patterns of answers, however, can and do disqualify them. And we do not know what those patterns are. We're not told what the tests are looking for. The process is entirely opaque. What's worse, after the model is calibrated by technical experts, it receives precious little feedback. Again, sports provide a good contrast here. Most professional basketball teams employ data geeks who run models that analyze players by a series of metrics, including foot speed, vertical leap, free throw percentage, and a host of other variables. When the draft comes, the Los Angeles Lakers might pass on a hotshot point guard from Duke because his assist statistics are low. Point guards have to be good passers. Yet, in the following season, they're dismayed to see that the rejected player goes on to win Rookie of the Year for the Utah Jazz and leads the league in assists. In such a case, the Lakers can return to their model to see what they got wrong. Maybe his college team was relying on him to score, which punished his assist numbers. Or perhaps he learned something important about passing in Utah. Whatever the case, they can work to improve their model. Now imagine that Kyle Beam, after getting red-lighted at Kroger, goes on to land a job at McDonald's. He turns into a stellar employee. He's managing the kitchen within 4 months and the entire franchise a year later. Will anyone at Kroger go back to the personality test and investigate how they could have gotten it so wrong? Not a chance, I'd say. The difference is this. Basketball teams are managing individuals, each one potentially worth millions of dollars. Their analytics engines are crucial to their competitive advantage, and they are hungry for data. Without constant feedback, their systems grow outdated and dumb. The companies hiring minimum wage workers, by contrast, are managing herds. They slash expenses by replacing human resources professionals with machines, and those machines filter large populations into more manageable groups. Unless something goes haywire in the workforce, an outbreak of kleptomania, say, or plummeting productivity, the company has little reason to tweak the filtering model. It's doing its job, even if it misses out on potential stars. The company may be satisfied with the status quo, but the victims of its automatic systems suffer. And as you might expect, I consider personality tests in hiring departments to be WMDs. They check all the boxes. First, they are in widespread use and have enormous impact. The Kronos exam, with all of its flaws, is scaled across much of the hiring economy. Under the previous status quo, employers no doubt had biases, but those biases varied from company to company, which might have cracked open a door somewhere for people like Kyle Beam. That's increasingly untrue. And Kyle was, in some sense, lucky. Job candidates, especially those applying for minimum wage work, get rejected all the time, and rarely find out why. It was just chance that Kyle's friend happened to hear about the reason for his rejection and told him about it. Even then, the case against the big Kronos users would likely have gone nowhere if Kyle's father hadn't been a lawyer, one with enough time and money to mount a broad legal challenge. This is rarely the case for low-level job applicants. Yes, it's true that many college-bound students labor for a summer or two in minimum-wage jobs, but if they have a miserable experience there, or are misjudged by an arbitrary WMD, it only reinforces the message that they should apply themselves at school and leave such hellish jobs behind. Finally, consider the feedback loop that the Kronos personality test engenders. Red-lighting people with certain mental health issues prevents them from having a normal job and leading a normal life, further isolating them. This is exactly what the Americans with Disabilities Act is supposed to prevent. The majority of job applicants, thankfully, are not blackballed by automatic systems. But they still face the challenge of moving their application to the top of the pile and landing an interview. This has long been a problem for racial and ethnic minorities as well as women. In 2001 and 2002, before the expansion of automatic resume readers, researchers from the University of Chicago and MIT sent out 5,000 phony resumes for job openings advertised in the Boston Globe and the Chicago Tribune. The jobs ranged from clerical work to customer service and sales. Each of the resumes was modeled for race. Half featured typically white names like Emily Walsh and Brandon Baker, while the others with similar qualifications carried names like Lakeisha Washington and Jamal Jones, which would sound African-American. The researchers found that the white names got 50% more callbacks than the black ones. But a secondary finding was perhaps even more striking. The white applicants with strong resumes got much more attention than whites with weaker ones. When it came to white applicants, it seemed, the hiring managers were paying attention. But among blacks, the stronger resumes barely made a difference. The hiring market clearly was still poisoned by prejudice. The ideal way to circumvent such prejudice is to consider applicants blindly. Orchestras, which have long been dominated by men, famously started in the 1970s to hold auditions with the musician hidden behind a sheet. Connections and reputation suddenly counted for nothing, nor did the musician's race or alma mater. The music from behind the sheet spoke for itself. Since then, the percentage of women playing in major orchestras has leapt by a factor of 5. Though they still make up only a quarter of the musicians. The trouble is that few professions can engineer such an even-handed tryout for job applicants. Musicians behind the sheet can actually perform the job they're applying for, whether it's a Dvorak cello concerto or bossa nova on guitar. In other professions, employers have to hunt through resumes looking for qualities that might predict success. As you might expect, human resources departments rely on automatic systems to winnow down piles of resumes. In fact, some 72% of resumes are never seen by human eyes. Computer programs flip through them, pulling out the skills and experiences that the employer is looking for. Then they score each resume as a match for the job opening. It's up to the people in the human resources department to decide where the cutoff is, but the more candidates they can eliminate with this first screening, the fewer human hours they'll have to spend processing the top matches. So job applicants must craft the resumes with that automatic reader in mind. It's important, for example, to sprinkle the resume liberally with words the specific job opening is looking for. This could include positions, sales manager, chief financial officer, software architect, languages, Mandarin, Java, or honors, summa cum laude, Eagle Scout. Those with the latest information learn what machines appreciate and what tangles them up. Images, for example, are useless. Most resume scanners don't yet process them. And fancy fonts do nothing but confuse the machines, says Mona Abdel-Halim. She's the co-founder of Resonate.com, a job application tool. The safe ones, she says, are plain vanilla fonts like Arial and Courier. And forget about symbols, such as arrows. They only confuse things, preventing the automatic systems from correctly parsing the information. The result of these programs, much as with college admissions, is that those with the money and resources to prepare their resumes come out on top. Those who don't take these steps may never know that they're sending their resumes into a black hole. It's one more example in which the wealthy and informed get the edge and the poor are likely to lose out. To be fair, the resume business has always had one sort of bias or another. In previous generations, those in the know were careful to organize the resume items clearly and consistently, type them on a quality computer like an IBM Selectric, and print them on paper with a high RAG content. Such resumes were more likely to make it past human screeners. More times than not, handwritten resumes or ones with smudges from mimeograph machines ended up in the circular file. So in this sense, the unequal paths to opportunity are nothing new. They have simply returned in a new incarnation, this time to guide society's winners past electronic gatekeepers. The unequal treatment at the hands of these gatekeepers extends far beyond resumes. Our livelihoods increasingly depend on our ability to make our case to machines. The clearest example of this is Google. For businesses, whether it's a bed and breakfast or an auto repair shop, success hinges on showing up on the first page of search results. Now, individuals face similar challenges, whether trying to get a foot in the door of a company, to climb the ranks, or even to survive waves of layoffs. The key is to learn what the machines are looking for, But here too, in a digital universe touted to be fair, scientific, and democratic, the insiders find a way to gain a crucial edge. In the 1970s, the admissions office at St. George's Hospital Medical School in the South London district of Tooting saw an opportunity. They received more than 12 applications for each of their 150 openings each year. Combing through all those applications was a lot of work, requiring multiple screeners. And since each of those screeners had different ideas and predilections, the process was somewhat capricious. Would it be possible to program a computer to sort through the applications and reduce the field to a more manageable number? Big organizations like the Pentagon and IBM were already using computers for such work. But for a medical school to come up with its own automated assessment program in the late 70s, just as Apple was releasing its first personal computer, represented a bold experiment. It turned out, however, to be an utter failure. St. George was not only precocious in its use of mathematical modeling, it seemed, but also an unwitting pioneer in WMDs. As with so many WMDs, the problem began at the get-go, when the administrators established the model's twin objectives. The first was to boost efficiency, letting the machine handle much of the grunt work. It would automatically cull down the 2,000 applications to 500, at which point humans would take over with a lengthy interviewing process. The second objective was fairness. The computer would remain unswayed by administrators' moods or prejudices, or by urgent entreaties from lords or cabinet ministers. In this first automatic screening, each applicant would be judged by the same criteria. And what would those criteria be? That looked like the easy part. St. George's already had voluminous records of screenings from the previous years. The job was to teach the computerized system how to replicate the same procedures that human beings had been following. As I'm sure you can guess, these inputs were the problem. The computer learned from the humans how to discriminate, and it carried out this work with breathtaking efficiency. In fairness to the administrators at St. George's, not all of the discrimination in the training data was overtly racist. A good number of the applications with foreign names or from foreign addresses came from people who clearly had not mastered the English language. Instead of considering the possibility that great doctors could learn English, which is obvious today, the tendency was simply to reject them. After all, the school had to discard 3/4 of the applications, and that seemed like an easy place to start. Now, while the human beings at St. George's had long tossed out applications littered with grammatical mistakes and misspellings, the computer, illiterate itself, could hardly follow suit. But it could correlate the rejected applications of the past with birthplaces and, to a lesser degree, surnames. So, people from certain places like Africa, Pakistan, and immigrant neighborhoods of the United Kingdom received lower overall scores and were not invited to interviews. An outsized proportion of these people were non-white. The human beings had also rejected female applicants, with the all-too-common justification that their careers could likely be interrupted by the duties of motherhood. The machine naturally did the same. In 1988, the British government's Commission for Racial Equality found the medical school guilty of racial and gender discrimination in its admissions policy. As many as 60 of the 2,000 applicants every year, according to the commission, may have been refused an interview purely because of their race, ethnicity, or gender. The solution for the statisticians at St. George's, and for those in other industries, would be to build a digital version of a blind audition eliminating proxies such as geography, gender, race, or name, to focus only on data relevant to medical education. The key is to analyze the skills each candidate brings to the school, not to judge him or her by comparison with people who seem similar. What's more, a bit of creative thinking at St. George's could have addressed the challenges facing women and foreigners. The British Medical Journal report accompanying the commission's judgment said as much. If language and childcare issues posed problems for otherwise solid candidates, the solution was not to reject those candidates, but instead to provide them with help, whether English classes or on-site daycare, to pull them through. This is a point I'll be returning to in future chapters. We've seen time and again that mathematical models can sift through data to locate people who are likely to face great challenges, whether from crime, poverty, or education. It's up to society whether to use that intelligence to reject and punish them or to reach out to them with the resources they need. We can use the scale and efficiency that make WMDs so pernicious in order to help people. It all depends on the objective we choose. So far in this chapter, we've been looking at models that filter out job candidates. For most companies, those WMDs are designed to cut administrative costs and to reduce the risk of bad hires, or ones that might require more training. The objectives of the filters, in short, is to save money. HR departments, of course, are also eager to save money through the hiring choices they make. One of the biggest expenses for a company is workforce turnover, commonly called churn. Replacing a worker earning $50,000 a year costs the company about $10,000, or 20% of that worker's yearly pay, according to the Center for American Progress. Replacing a high-level employee can cost multiples of that, as much as 2 years of salary. Naturally, many hiring models attempt to calculate the likelihood that each job candidate will stick around. Evolve Inc., now part of Cornerstone On Demand, helped Xerox scout out prospects for its calling center, which employs more than 40,000 people. The churn model took into account some of the metrics you might expect, including the average time people stuck around on previous jobs. But they also found some intriguing correlations. People the system classified as creative types tended to stay longer at the job, while those who scored high on inquisitiveness were more likely to set their questioning minds toward other opportunities. But the most problematic correlation had to do with geography. Job applicants who lived farther from the job were more likely to churn. This makes sense. Long commutes are a pain. But Xerox managers noticed another correlation. Many of the people suffering those long commutes were coming from poor neighborhoods. So Xerox, to its credit, removed that highly correlated churn data from its model. The company sacrificed a bit of efficiency for fairness. While churn analysis focuses on the candidates most likely to fail, the more strategically vital job for HR departments is to locate future stars, the people whose intelligence, inventiveness, and drive can change the course of an entire enterprise. In the higher echelons of the economy, companies are on the hunt for employees who think creatively and work well in teams. So the modeler's challenge is to pinpoint, in the vast world of big data, the bits of information that correlate with originality and social skills. Resumes alone certainly don't cut it. Most of the items listed there, prestigious university, the awards, even the skills, are crude proxies for high-quality work. While there's no doubt some correlation between tech prowess and a degree from a top school, it's far from perfect. Plenty of software talent comes from elsewhere. Consider the high school hackers. What's more, resumes are full of puffery, and sometimes even lies. With a quick search through LinkedIn or Facebook, a system can look further afield, identifying some of the candidate's friends and colleagues. But it's still hard to turn that data into a prediction that a certain engineer might be a perfect fit for a 12-member consultancy in Palo Alto or Fort Worth. Finding the person to fill a role like that requires a far broader sweep of data and a more ambitious model. A pioneer in this field is Guild, a San Francisco-based startup. Extending far beyond a prospect's alma mater or resume, Guild sorts through millions of job sites, analyzing what it calls each person's social data. The company develops profiles of job candidates for its customers, mostly tech companies, keeping them up to date as the candidates add new skills. Guild claims that it can even predict when a star employee is likely to change jobs and can alert its customer companies when it's the right time to make an offer. But Guild's models attempt to quantify and also qualify each worker's social capital. How integral is this person to the community of fellow programmers? Do they share and contribute code? Say a Brazilian coder, Pedro, let's call him, lives in Sao Paulo and spends every evening from dinner to 1 in the morning in communion with fellow coders the world over, solving cloud computing problems or brainstorming gaming algorithms on sites like GitHub or Stack Overflow. The model could attempt to gauge Pedro's passion, which probably gets a high score, and his level of engagement with others. It would also evaluate the skill and social importance of his contacts. Those with larger followings would count for more. If his principal online contact happened to be Google's Sergey Brin or Palmer Luckey, founder of the virtual reality maker Oculus VR, Pedro's social score would no doubt shoot through the roof. But models like Guild's rarely receive such explicit signals from the data. So they cast a wider net in search of correlations to workplace stardom wherever they can find them. And with more than 6 million coders in their database, the company can find all kinds of patterns. Vivian Ming, Guild's chief scientist, said in an interview with Atlantic Monthly that Guild had found a bevy of talent frequenting a certain Japanese manga site. If Pedro spends time at that comic book site, of course, it doesn't predict superstardom, but it does nudge up his score. That makes sense for Pedro. But certain workers might be doing something else offline, which even the most sophisticated algorithm couldn't infer. At least not today. They might be taking care of children, for example, or perhaps attending a book group. The fact that prospects don't spend 6 hours discussing manga every evening shouldn't be counted against them. And if, like most of Tectum, that manga site is dominated by males and has a sexual tone, a good number of the women in the industry will probably avoid it. Despite these issues, Guild is just one player. It doesn't have the clout of a global giant, and is not positioned to set a single industry standard. Compared to some of the horrors we've seen, the predatory ads burying families in debt and the personality tests excluding people from opportunities, Guild is tame. Its category of predictive model has more to do with rewarding people than punishing them. No doubt the analysis is uneven. Some potential stars are undoubtedly overlooked, but I don't think the talent miners yet rise to the level of a WMD. Still, it's important to note that these hiring and onboarding models are ever evolving. The world of data continues to expand, with each of us producing ever-growing streams of updates about our lives. All of this data will feed our potential employers, giving them insights into us. Will those insights be tested or simply used to justify the status quo and reinforce prejudices? When I consider the sloppy and self-serving ways that companies use data, I'm often reminded of phrenology, a pseudoscience that was briefly the rage in the 19th century. Phrenologists would run their fingers over the patient's skull, probing for bumps and indentations. Each one, they thought, was linked to personality traits that existed in 27 regions of the brain. Usually the conclusion of the phrenologist jived with the observations he made. If a patient was morbidly anxious or suffering from alcoholism, the skull probe would usually find bumps and dips that correlated with that observation, which in turn bolstered faith in the science of phrenology. Phrenology was a model that relied on pseudoscientific nonsense to make authoritative pronouncements, and for decades it went untested. Big data can fall into the same trap. Models like the ones that red-lighted Kyle Beam and blackballed foreign medical students at St. George's can lock people out even when the science inside them is little more than a bundle of untested assumptions. Chapter 7. Sweating Bullets. On the Job. Workers at major corporations in America recently came up with a new verb, clopening. That's when an employee works late one night to close the store or cafe and then returns a few hours later before dawn to open it. Having the same employee closing and opening, or clopening, often makes logistical sense for a company, but it leads to sleep-deprived workers and crazy schedules. Wildly irregular schedules are becoming increasingly common, and they especially affect low-wage workers at companies like Starbucks, McDonald's, and Walmart. A lack of notice compounds the problem. Many employees find out only a day or two in advance that they'll have to work a Wednesday night shift or handle rush hour on Friday. It throws their life into chaos and wreaks havoc on childcare plans. Meals are catch-as-catch-can, as is sleep. These irregular schedules are a product of the data economy. In the last chapter, we saw how WMDs sift through job candidates, blackballing some and ignoring many more. We saw how the software often encodes poisonous prejudices, learning from past records just how to be unfair. Here we continue the journey onto the job, where efficiency-focused WMDs treat workers as cogs in a machine. Clopening is just one product of this trend, which is likely to grow as surveillance extends into the workplace, providing more grist for the data economy. For decades, before companies were swimming in data, scheduling was anything but a science. Imagine a family-owned hardware store whose clerks work from 9 to 5, 6 days a week. One year, the daughter goes to college, and when she comes back for the summer, she sees the business with fresh eyes. She notices that practically no one comes to the store on Tuesday mornings. The clerk web surfs on her phone, uninterrupted. That's a revenue drain. Meanwhile, on Saturdays, muttering customers wait in long lines. These observations provide valuable data, and she helps her parents model the business to it. They start by closing the store on Tuesday mornings, and they hire a part-timer to help with the Saturday crush. These changes add a bit of intelligence to the dumb and inflexible status quo. With big data, that college freshman is replaced by legions of PhDs with powerful computers in tow. Businesses can now analyze customer traffic to calculate exactly how many employees they will need each hour of the day. The goal, of course, is to spend as little money as possible, which means keeping staffing at the bare minimum while making sure that reinforcements are on hand for the busy times. You might think that these patterns would repeat week after week, and that companies could simply make adjustments to their fixed schedules, just like the owners of our hypothetical hardware store. But new software scheduling programs offer far more sophisticated options. They process new streams of ever-changing data, from the weather to pedestrian patterns. A rainy afternoon, for example, will likely drive people from the park into cafes. So they'll need more staffing, at least for an hour or two. High school football on Friday night might mean more foot traffic on Main Street, but only before and after the game, not during it. Twitter volume suggests that 26% more shoppers will rush out to tomorrow's Black Friday sales than did last year. Conditions change, hour by hour, and the workforce must be deployed to match the fluctuating demand. Otherwise, the company is wasting money. The money saved, naturally, comes straight from employees' pockets. Under the inefficient status quo, workers had not only predictable hours, but also a certain amount of downtime. You could argue that they benefited from inefficiency. Some were able to read on the job, even study. Now, with software choreographing the work, every minute should be busy. And these minutes will come whenever the program demands it, even if it means clopening from Friday to Saturday. In 2014, the New York Times ran a story about a harried single mother named Janet Navarro, who was trying to work her way through college as a barista at Starbucks while caring for her four-year-old. The ever-changing schedule, including the occasional clopening, made her life almost impossible and put regular daycare beyond reach. She had to put school on hold. The only thing she could schedule was work, and her story was typical. According to U.S. government data, 2/3 of food service workers and more than half of retail workers find out about scheduling changes with notice of a week or less, often just a day or two, which can leave them scrambling to arrange transportation or childcare. Within weeks of the article's publication, the major corporations it mentioned announced that they would adjust their scheduling practices. Embarrassed by the story, the employers promised to add a single constraint to their model. They would eliminate clopenings and learn to live with slightly less robust optimization. Starbucks, whose brand hinges more than most on fair treatment of workers, went further, saying that the company would adjust the software to reduce the scheduling nightmares for its 130,000 baristas. All work hours would be posted at least 1 week in advance. A year later, however, Starbucks was failing to meet these targets, or even to eliminate the clopenings, according to a follow-up report in the Times. The trouble was that minimal staffing was baked into the culture. In many companies, managers' pay is contingent upon the efficiency of their staff as measured by revenue per employee hour. Scheduling software helps them boost these numbers and their own compensation. Even when executives tell managers to loosen up, they often resist. It goes against everything they've been taught. What's more, at Starbucks, if a manager exceeds his or her labor budget, a district manager is alerted, said one employee, and that could lead to a write-up. It's usually easier just to change someone's schedule, even if it means violating the corporate pledge to provide 1 week's notice. In the end, the business models of publicly traded companies like Starbucks are built to feed the bottom line. That's reflected in their corporate cultures and their incentives, and increasingly in their operational software. And if that software allows for tweaks, as Starbucks does, the ones that are made are likely to be the ones that boost profits. Much of the scheduling technology has its roots in a powerful discipline of applied mathematics called operations research, or OR. For centuries, mathematicians used the rudiments of OR to help farmers plan crop plantings and help civil engineers map highways to move people and goods efficiently. But the discipline didn't really take off until World War II, when the U.S. and British military enlisted teams of mathematicians to optimize their use of resources. The Allies kept track of various forms of an exchange ratio, which compared Allied resources spent versus enemy resources destroyed. During Operation Starvation, which took place between March and August 1945, the 21st Bomber Command was tasked with destroying Japanese merchant ships in order to prevent food and other goods from arriving safely on Japanese shores. OR teams worked to minimize the number of mine-laying aircraft for each Japanese merchant ship that was sunk. They managed an exchange ratio of over 40 to 1. Only 15 aircraft were lost in sinking 606 Japanese ships. This was considered highly efficient and was due in part to the work of the OR team. Following World War II, major companies, as well as the Pentagon, poured enormous resources into OR. The science of logistics radically transformed the way we produce goods and bring them to market. In the 1960s, Japanese auto companies made another major leap, devising a manufacturing system called just-in-time. The idea was that instead of storing mountains of steering wheels or transmission blocks and retrieving them from vast warehouses, the assembly plant would order parts as they were needed rather than paying for them to sit idle. Toyota and Honda established complex chains of suppliers, each of them constantly bringing in parts on call. It was as if the industry were a single organism with its own homeostatic control systems. Just-in-time was highly efficient, and it quickly spread across the globe. Companies in many geographies can establish just-in-time supply chains in a snap. These models likewise constitute the mathematical underpinnings of companies like Amazon, Federal Express, and UPS. Scheduling software can be seen as an extension of the just-in-time economy. But instead of lawnmower blades or cell phone screens showing up right on cue, it's people, usually people who badly need money. And because they need money so desperately, the companies can bend their lives to the dictates of a mathematical model. I should add that companies take steps not to make people's lives too miserable. They all know, to the penny, how much it costs to replace a frazzled worker who finally quits. Those numbers are in the data too. And they have other models, as we discussed in the last chapter, to reduce churn, which drains profits and efficiency. The trouble, from the employee's perspective, is an oversupply of low-wage labor. People are hungry for work, which is why so many of them cling to jobs that pay barely $8 per hour. This oversupply, along with a scarcity of effective unions, leaves workers with practically no bargaining power. This means the big retailers and restaurants can twist the workers' lives to ever more absurd schedules without suffering from excessive churn. They make more money while their workers' lives grow hellish. And because these optimization programs are everywhere, the workers know all too well that changing jobs isn't likely to improve their lot. Taken together, these dynamics provide corporations with something close to a captive workforce. I'm sure it comes as no surprise that I consider scheduling software one of the more appalling WMDs. It's massive, as we've discussed, and it takes advantage of people who are already struggling to make ends meet. What's more, it is entirely opaque. Workers often don't have a clue about when they'll be called to work. They are summoned by an arbitrary program. Scheduling software also creates a poisonous feedback loop. Consider Janet Navarro. Her haphazard scheduling made it impossible for her to return to school, which dampened her employment prospects and kept her in the oversupplied pool of low-wage workers. The long and irregular hours also made it hard for workers to organize or to protest for better conditions. Instead, they face heightened anxiety and sleep deprivation, which causes dramatic mood swings and is responsible for an estimated 13% of highway deaths. Worse yet, since the software is designed to save companies money, it often limits workers' hours to fewer than 30 per week, so that they are not eligible for company health insurance. And with their chaotic schedules, most find it impossible to make time for a second job. It's almost as if the software were designed expressly to punish low-wage workers and to keep them down. The software also condemns a large percentage of our children to grow up without routines. They experience their mother bleary-eyed at breakfast, or hurrying out the door without dinner, or arguing with her mother about who can take care of them on Sunday morning. This chaotic life affects children deeply. According to a study by the Economic Policy Institute, an advocacy group, quote, young children and adolescents of parents working unpredictable schedules or outside standard daytime working hours are more likely to have inferior cognition and behavioral outcomes, unquote. The parents might blame themselves for having a child who acts out or fails in school, but in many cases, the real culprit is the poverty that leads workers to take jobs with haphazard schedules and the scheduling models that squeeze struggling families even harder. The root of the trouble, as with so many other WMDs, is the modeler's choice of objectives. The model is optimized for efficiency and profitability, not for justice or the good of the team. This is, of course, the nature of capitalism. For companies, revenue is like oxygen. It keeps them alive. From their perspective, it would be profoundly stupid, even unnatural, to turn away from potential savings. That's why society needs countervailing forces, such as vigorous press coverage that highlights the abuses of efficiency and shames companies into doing the right thing. And when they come up short, as Starbucks did, it must expose them again and again. It also needs regulators to keep them in line, strong unions to organize workers and amplify their needs and complaints, and politicians willing to pass laws to restrain corporations' worst excesses. Following the New York Times report in 2014, Democrats in Congress promptly drew up bills to rein in scheduling software. But facing a Republican majority fiercely opposed to government regulations, the chances that their bill would become law were nil. The legislation died. In 2008, just as the Great Recession was approaching, a San Francisco company called Catafora marketed a software system that rated tech workers on a number of metrics, including their generation of ideas. This was no easy task. Software programs, after all, are hard-pressed to distinguish between an idea and a simple string of words. If you think about it, the difference is often just a matter of context. Yesterday's ideas, that the earth is round, or even that people might like to share photos in social networks, are today's facts. We humans each have a sense for when an idea becomes an established fact, and know when it has been debunked or discarded, though we often disagree. However, that distinction flummoxes even the most sophisticated AI. So Catafora's system needed to look to humans themselves for guidance. Catafora's software burrowed into corporate email and messaging in its hunt for ideas. Its guiding hypothesis was that the best ideas would tend to spread more widely through the network. If people cut and pasted certain groups of words and shared them, those words were likely ideas, and the software could quantify them. But there were complications. Ideas were not the only groups of words that were widely shared on social networks. Jokes, for example, were wildly viral and equally befuddling to software systems. Gossip also traveled like a rocket. However, jokes and gossip followed certain patterns, so it was possible to teach the program to filter out at least some of them. With time, the system identified the groups of words most likely to represent ideas. It tracked them through the network, counting the number of times they were copied, measuring their distribution and identifying their source. Very soon, the roles of the employees appeared to come into focus. Some people were idea generators, the system concluded. On its chart of employees, Catafora marked idea generators with circles, which were bigger and darker if they produced lots of ideas. Other people were connectors. Like neurons in a distributed network, they transmitted information. The most effective connectors made snippets of words go viral. The system painted those people in dark colors as well. Now, whether or not this system effectively measured the flow of ideas, the concept itself was not nefarious. It can make sense to use this type of analysis to identify what people know and to match them with their most promising colleagues and collaborators. IBM and Microsoft use in-house programs to do just this. It's very similar to a dating algorithm, and often, no doubt, has similarly spotty results. Big data has also been used to study the productivity of call center workers. A few years ago, MIT researchers analyzed the behavior of call center employees for Bank of America to find out why some teams were more productive than others. They hung a so-called sociometric badge around each employee's neck. The electronics in these badges tracked the employee's location and also measured every 16 milliseconds their tone of voice and gestures. It recorded when people were looking at each other and how much each person talked, listened, and interrupted. Four teams of call center employees, 80 people in total, wore these badges for 6 weeks. These employees' jobs were highly regimented. Talking was discouraged because workers were supposed to spend as many of their minutes as possible on the phone, solving customers' problems. Coffee breaks were scheduled one by one. The researchers found, to their surprise, that the fastest and most efficient call center team was also the most social. These employees poo-pooed the rules and gabbed much more than the others. And when all the employees were encouraged to socialize more, call center productivity soared. But data studies that track employees' behavior can also be used to cull a workforce. As the 2008 recession ripped through the economy, HR officials in the tech sector started to look at those Cata4 charts with a new purpose. They saw that some workers were represented as big dark circles, while others were smaller and dimmer. If they had to lay off workers, and most companies did, it made sense to start with the small and dim ones on the chart. Were those workers really expendable? Again, we come to digital phrenology. If a system designates a worker as a low idea generator or weak connector, that verdict becomes its own truth. That's her score. Perhaps someone can come in with countervailing evidence. The worker with the dim circle might generate fabulous ideas, but not share them on the network. Or perhaps she proffers priceless advice over lunch or breaks up the tension in the office with a joke. Maybe everybody likes her. That has great value in the workplace. But competing systems have trouble finding digital proxies for these kinds of soft skills. The relevant data simply isn't collected. And anyway, it's hard to put a value on them. They're usually easier to leave out of a model. So the system identifies apparent losers, and a good number of them lost their jobs during the recession. That alone is unjust. But what's worse is that systems like Cata4's receive minimal feedback data. Someone identified as a loser and subsequently fired may have found another job and generated a fistful of patents. That data usually isn't collected. The system has no inkling that it got one person or even 1,000 people entirely wrong. That's a problem, because scientists need this error feedback, in this case the presence of false negatives, to delve into forensic analysis and figure out what went wrong, what was misread, what data was ignored. It's how systems learn and get smarter. Yet, as we've seen, loads of WMDs, from recidivism models to teacher scores, blithely generate their own reality. Managers assume that the scores are true enough to be useful, and the algorithm makes tough decisions easy. They can fire employees and cut costs and blame their decisions on an objective number, whether it's accurate or not. Cata4 remained small, and its worker evaluation model was a sideline. Much more of its work was in identifying patterns of fraud or insider trading within companies. The company went out of business in 2012, and its software was sold to a startup, Chinope. But systems like Cata4's have the potential to become true WMDs. They can misinterpret people and punish them without any proof that their scores correlate to the quality of their work. This type of software signals the rise of WMDs in a new realm. For a few decades, it might have seemed that industrial workers and service workers were the only ones who could be modeled and optimized, while those who trafficked in ideas, from lawyers to chemical engineers, could steer clear of WMDs, at least at work. Cata4 was an early warning that this will not be the case. Indeed, throughout the tech industry, many companies are busy trying to optimize their white-collar workers by looking at the patterns of their communications. The tech giants, including Google, Facebook, Amazon, IBM, and many others, are hot on this trail. For now at least, this diversity is welcome. It holds out the hope, at least, that workers rejected by one model might be appreciated by another. But eventually, an industry standard will emerge, and then we'll all be in trouble. In 1983, the Reagan administration issued a lurid alarm about the state of America's schools. In a report called A Nation at Risk, a presidential panel warned that a rising tide of mediocrity in the schools threatened our very future as a nation and a people. The report added that if, quote, an unfriendly foreign power had attempted to impose these bad schools on us, we might well have viewed it as an act of war. The most noteworthy signal of failure was what appeared to be plummeting scores on the SATs. Between 1963 and 1980, verbal scores had fallen by 50 points, and math scores were down 40 points. Our ability to compete in a global economy hinged on our skills, and they seemed to be worsening. Who was to blame for this sorry state of affairs? The report left no doubt about that. Teachers. The Nation at Risk report called for action, which meant testing the students and using the results to zero in on the underperforming teachers. As we heard in the introduction, this practice can cost teachers their jobs. Sarah Wysocki, the teacher in Washington who was fired after her class posted surprisingly low scores, was the victim of such a test. My point in telling that story was to show a WMD in action, how it can be arbitrary, unfair, and deaf to appeals. But along with being educators and caretakers of children, Teachers are obviously workers, and here I want to delve a bit deeper into the models that score their performance, because they might spread to other parts of the workforce. Consider the case of Tim Clifford. He's a middle school English teacher in New York City, with 26 years of experience. A few years ago, Clifford learned that he had bombed on a teacher evaluation, a so-called value-added model similar to the one that led to Sarah Wysocki's firing. Clifford's score was an abysmal 6 out of 100. He was devastated. "I didn't see how it was possible that I could have worked so hard and gotten such poor results," he later told me. "To be honest, when I first learned my low score, I felt ashamed and didn't tell anyone for a day or so. However, I learned that there were actually two other teachers who scored below me in my school. That emboldened me to share my results, because I wanted those teachers to know it wasn't only them." If Clifford hadn't had tenure, he could have been dismissed that year, he said. "Even with tenure," he said, "scoring low in consecutive years is bound to put a target on a teacher's back to some degree. What's more, when tenured teachers register low scores, it emboldens school reformers, who make the case that job security protects incompetent educators." Clifford approached the following year with trepidation. The value-added model had given him a failing grade, but no advice on how to improve it. So Clifford went on teaching the way he always had, and hoped for the best. The following year, his score was a 96. "You'd think I'd have been elated, but I wasn't," he said. "I knew that my low score was bogus, so I could hardly rejoice at getting a high score using the same flawed formula. The 90% difference in my scores only made me realize how ridiculous the entire value-added model is when it comes to education." Bogus is the word for it. In fact, misinterpreted statistics run through the history of teacher evaluation. The problem started with a momentous statistical boo-boo in the analysis of the original Nation at Risk report. It turned out that the very researchers who were decrying a national catastrophe were basing their judgment on a fundamental error, something an undergrad should have caught. In fact, if they wanted to serve up an example of America's educational shortcomings, their own misreading of statistics could serve as Exhibit A. 7 years after A Nation at Risk was published with such fanfare, researchers at Sandia National Laboratories took a second look at the data gathered for the report. These people were no amateurs when it came to statistics. They build and maintain nuclear weapons, and they quickly found the error. Yes, it was true that SAT scores had gone down on average. However, the number of students taking the test had ballooned over the course of those 17 years. Universities were opening their doors to more poor students and minorities. Opportunities were expanding. This signaled social success. But naturally, this influx of newcomers dragged down the average scores. However, when statisticians broke down the population into income groups, scores for every single group were rising, from the poor to the rich. In statistics, this phenomenon is known as Simpson's paradox. When a whole body of data displays one trend, yet when broken into subgroups, the opposite trend comes into view for each of those subgroups. The damning conclusion in the Nation at Risk report, the one that spurred the entire teacher evaluation movement, was drawn from a grievous misinterpretation of the data. Tim Clifford's diverging scores are the result of yet another case of botched statistics, this one all too common. The teacher scores derived from the test measured nothing. This may sound like hyperbole. After all, kids took tests, and those scores contributed to Clifford's. That much is true. But Clifford's scores, both his humiliating 6 and his chest-thumping 96, were based almost entirely on approximations that were so weak, they were essentially random. The problem was that the administrators lost track of accuracy in their quest to be fair. They understood that it wasn't right for teachers in rich schools to get too much credit when the sons and daughters of doctors and lawyers marched off toward elite universities. Nor should teachers in poor districts be held to the same standards of achievement. We cannot expect them to perform miracles. So instead of measuring teachers on an absolute scale, they tried to adjust for social inequalities in the model. Instead of comparing Tim Clifford's students to others in different neighborhoods, they would compare them with forecast models of themselves. The students each had a predicted score. If they surpassed this prediction, the teacher got the credit. If they came up short, the teacher got the blame. If that sounds primitive to you, believe me, it is. Statistically speaking, In these attempts to free the tests from class and color, the administrators moved from a primary to a secondary model. Instead of basing scores on direct measurement of the students, they based them on the so-called error term, the gap between results and expectations. Mathematically, this is a much sketchier proposition,